Hey everyone, welcome to the Mass Construction Show with today's guest, Scott Wadsworth, aka The Essential Craftsman. I'm your host, Joe Kelly, and this is a podcast about all things construction in Massachusetts and beyond. In this episode, we discuss Scott's atypical path through construction, from logger to commercial construction worker, piecework carpenter, owning his own general contracting firm, then dabbling in blacksmithing, and now becoming a full-time YouTuber in his 60s. And a legit YouTuber with over 500,000 subscribers. There's so much to learn from this gentleman, including job satisfaction, how to build, and not wavering on the profit you enjoy. Excuse me, you deserve. Enjoy the show. Hey, Scott, welcome to the Mass Construction Show.
Joe, good morning. Nice to meet you.
Yes, I appreciate that you were up at the crack of dawn for this because you're on West Coast time, 5:30, right?
Yeah, but I'm an old man, so I always wake up between 3:30 and 4 anyhow, so you did not disrupt my schedule, let me just say that.
Yeah, you shamed me with your response with, oh yeah, that's fine, I'll be up at 3:30, I'll exercise, drink a tall glass of ice water. I was like, oh man, this guy.
So some of that was posturing, okay? I typically don't drink a tall glass of ice water before 4 a.m., but yeah, we're out of bed early.
Okay, actually, you know what's funny? I thought you were serious because I'm big into the way I eat, and I study a lot about health, and there has a lot to do with like shocking the system, and a lot of people say drinking an ice cold glass of water is a really good thing to do first thing in the morning to get everything going. So I was like, oh, this guy studied up, you know?
Right on.
Yeah. So, Scott, for some of the folks that might not be aware, what is it that you do currently? I know you've got a long history here, right. But just focus in the now. What are you currently doing?
So in the now, right now, I am building and I'm plating and detailing the walls on about a 2,900 square foot story and a half, two-story Craftsman home on a fairly adverse grade lot here in Roseburg, Oregon. And I'm doing it specifically for the content, the YouTube content, because about 3.5 years ago, my son and I started a YouTube channel. My son, Nate, he's 36, and he's the brains of this social media venture. I'm the eye candy, and you know, I say that and people laugh because when they're looking at me, they can see the incongruity. But I'm the guy on the screen and he's the guy behind the camera. And of the two, he has a lot more thinking to do. But yeah, I'm now after 40 some number of years in a blue collar labor and skilled labor and contracting business paradigm. I find myself a YouTuber. And so that's what my day to day is now.
Yeah, it's so funny. I mean, I only can imagine how you feel being in those shoes, but if you don't mind me asking, so how old are you?
I am 61 years old, and I feel every week of it framing these walls, okay?
Okay, so you're 61 years old. You're a 61-year-old YouTuber. To me, I hear that. I hear YouTuber, and I think of, you know, someone much younger and maybe doing skating videos. I know there's a whole lot more to it than that. But, you know, the image you get is something is not a 61-year-old guy framing houses and doing blacksmithing.
Yeah. Wearing suspenders and getting up at 3:30 a.m. and
it's great. So it must feel strange to you, maybe a bit surreal that you're correct me if I'm wrong, it's your full-time job, correct?
It's a full-time job. Yeah, so you are too young to remember a television show called The Twilight Zone. Did you ever see remakes or cuts of The Twilight Zone?
Yeah. I mean, it was black and white. I mean, yes, when I was a kid, they used to run reruns of it or whatever.
So I'm living in the Twilight Zone, man. I would have never, number one, it would not have been possible for me to imagine this because the internet and certainly YouTube, I mean, nobody was thinking those thoughts. And now to find myself squarely in the middle of it where my day-to-day and my late night calls and conversations and emails and every minute of the day is interacting with, it was unforeseen and unforeseeable. And so that is a paradigm shift in itself because I'm kind of a planning guy. I like to plan. I like to sort of, I like systems. I like to create systems that I can. And this was a system derailleur. I mean, this did not exist in any system I could imagine. And it was my 36-year-old millennial generation son who brought this whole thing. And so I guess that explains the incongruity of it, maybe.
Okay. Yeah. Now, see, that seems very inconsistent to the picture of you I have from watching a lot of your stuff. Let's do this. We'll talk a little bit more about your stuff, and then I'll say why it's why your comment there didn't strike me as making sense. Mm-hmm. So you talk about the spec house, which is a thing you're doing right now, where you're walking through every stage of building a home, mm-hmm. shooting the videos, educating people on how that works, right? But you also, I mean, you run the gamut. Some of your videos are about blacksmithing, various forms of carpentry,
logging, all sorts of things.
Yeah. Logging, tools and equipment with chainsaws, safety. This, mm-hmm. in some degree, there's a little bit of motivation in there sometimes too, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you see this motivation, safety, building home. So it's quite a wide variety of construction content in there. And I think about it, and then I also hear that you're a musician and a general contractor at one point, and I'm like, wow, he's kind of a lot like me in a sense.
Cool.
That I like to do so many different things. I would struggle with being in one particular thing for too long. But you don't typically think of those people that have lots of varied interests and career paths being systems people.
Interesting. So yeah, I'm a variety junkie. You know, if the learning curve is not if it's not inclined pretty steeply, I just can't maintain attention. And that's been a weakness in terms of acquisition and finance and net worth. It's been a weakness to have to have that mental stimulation of learning something new. But still, I guess my systems comment is more in my construction process, because I am a firm believer after working with hundreds and hundreds of people. And let me just say that when I use a masculine pronoun in connection with my construction experience, it's just because that's been my construction experience.
Yeah.
I'm a dinosaur. I come from 40 plus years of working with men in the field. And so when I say that I've worked with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of men, it's not the smallest exaggeration. And I've recognized that the most efficient people, the people that get the most work done, were the people that think of the work in segments and break it down into systems, and that their productivity at the end of the day was less a function of how fast they were moving and how hard they were working than it was a function of the system that they had in place before they ever started work that morning. And so in construction, I've gravitated to that. Now, in my personal life, in my desk and in my notes and in my pile, when I die, it will be from paper cuts. I hate paper. Paper defeats me all the time. I lose it. And so don't think that I'm really systematic. It's just when I get to construction, I tend to get systematic.
It's funny that you say that. I did a $450 million project, and we were a general contractor, more of a CM. We didn't self-perform anything, but we had laborers and carpenters on the job that would handle cleanup, maybe something that wasn't in a subcontractor scope. Mm-hmm. Safety, so handrails, tow boards, stairs and ramps, building loading docks, things like that. Mm-hmm. And we did the whole thing with one carpenter.
Really?
Yes. We weren't framing, we weren't drywalling,
sure.
Right? You know, and he was an older guy, and it's funny, his name was Joe. And
he wasn't as old as 61, was he?
I think he was.
Whoa, right? Cool.
Yeah. And because he retired shortly after, and maybe it was his experience, but and everybody called him Smokey, but he didn't smoke, and like he was the quietest guy you ever met. But it took a while to get used to it when I was first on the job with him, because say, all right, Joe, we got to have all these handrails up by Thursday or whatever. And he would set up his shop on a separate floor. You know, he's got a table. He's spending all this time setting up and. Like, geez, we've got 2 days and there, I don't see one stanchion on that floor. Mm-hmm. And then Wednesday would come and he would just put these systems together in prefab before prefab was a hot topic, right?
Yes.
Build this thing, boom, boom, boom. And then
all of a sudden, within an hour, the whole floor was done.
That's it.
You know, and you just had to learn to, but the first few times you're like, all right, Joe, like, I don't see anything. You're killing me.
The clock's running, man. The clock's running.
Yep. And he wouldn't break a sweat. You never saw him even walk remotely fast. Mm-hmm. He was just slow, never said a word. And I think that's what you're talking about, right?
That is what I'm talking about. I took a little construction management seminar. I worked for a company in Las Vegas, Martin Harris Construction. Frank Martin built just a really exceptional company down there. Sort of a classic American construction success story in Las Vegas. And he sent his foreman and on up to this construction management class. And the thing I took away from that, and perhaps you've heard this, but modern construction must be considered as the in-place mass production of one-of-a-kind items. Mm-hmm. And you think about that, and the more carefully you think about it, the more it resonates. Because in construction, it's always in place. You're not in a manufacturing facility. And every task is a one-of-a-kind item, but you must adopt and be looking for mass production systems, which is what your Joe did. He would set up a little mass production opportunity in place and crank it out. And there's just so much truth to that.
Yeah, there is. And you know what's funny? That 61-year-old or 60-something-year-old carpenter, right?
Yeah.
Outworked, I don't know, you know, 6 25-year-olds.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And he never walked slower than like a after-dinner stroll, right? Yeah. So it was amazing. You might like this, and folks that listen have heard me say this a couple times because I found it to be such a great way of looking at it. And it's very similar to your comment you just made, which is there was a guy working for Katerra, which is a company that is in the business of modular construction. Mm-hmm. And he came from the tech side, the cell phone business. And he said, what we do in construction, any other business would call it a prototype.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
You're designing it, you're coordinating it, you're building it like it's the first time it was ever built.
Absolutely.
Right? And like you were pointing out, the people that are successful are the people that can take that prototype and then insert the systems.
Yes.
To gain the efficiencies, right?
So there was a guy, I think, in the 60s in Great Britain, David Pye, and he wrote this beautiful little book. It's I think his only paperback. But it is the art and nature of workmanship, I think. And I think he invented this thought or this term, and he would compare and contrast workmanship of risk with workmanship of certainty. And he spoke, and so think of workmanship of certainty as a table saw or a shaper that's jigged up, and every time you introduce a board, you're going to get exactly the same profile. Or you can expand that to modern. You know, the Industrial Revolution was all about making everything into workmanship of certainty. You have a machine, you input the commodity, the finished material comes out the other end with no more human interaction than that. But workmanship of risk is, think of an elaborate wood carving, or you're blacksmithing a project, or you're framing a house. Everything you do has the risk of catastrophic failure based on your workmanship. And the more work you input, like think of a really nice carving or a carved piece of art, or Michelangelo's David, okay? He's chiseling away at that block, and the more labor he invests, the more the likelihood of a sudden catastrophic slip increases, until for the final 10% of the work, it's all on the line with every blow. That's workmanship of risk. And so the whole idea, so this David Pye talked about people that set up manufacturing facilities, and he would have and probably should have included construction carpenters as the last refuge of workmanship of risk. Mm. Everything's a prototype. You don't know if it's going to work. You don't know if this is going to be right until you're done. And then once you're done, the certainty enters, and everybody that comes after benefits from your risk taking. And so anyhow, I've loved and continue to love that idea. And I tell myself as I go, okay, this is workmanship of risk. Pay attention. And then you try to systemize it, become systematic, and reduce it to workmanship of certainty. So the guy coming behind you can read your layout and stage the material appropriately, and the scaffolding is safe, and. It's just an interesting way to think about a blue-collar work effort.
Yeah, I mean, I I like that concept, and I think the place you could go with it from a big picture would be, how could you take your construction project, which might be 30% risk, mm-hmm. right? How do you move it into the move more of it into the management of certainty?
Yes. Yep.
Right.
As you do that, profitability goes up.
Yes.
Okay? Yep. Mistakes go down. Productivity goes up. You anticipate quantities. Waste falls off. And so as you get into certainty, profit goes up and work satisfaction goes down. At least it always did for me. You know, in fact, my partner, Cy Swan, you'll see he's more than a partner. He's my blacksmithing mentor and friend. That wonderful Renaissance man, old Renaissance man, will intentionally input risk into almost everything he does. And it makes me crazy because he will intentionally, and I think it's somewhat subliminal, but if there's not an element of risk, if there's not the possibility of getting hurt or hurting the work, he loses interest. And it's just an interesting sort of a personality aspect that he has. And I haven't met many people like him.
Yeah, but it's funny. You've said the same thing though earlier, right? Just in a different way. You know, how if there's not a steep enough learning curve there, then you're not really interested.
That's very true. I hadn't thought of that. Maybe this whole a variety junkie thing is really a quest to input a little risk. You know, that if you're not learning and if there's not an element of failure all the time, it's just not worth it.
But I think it's good. But I think maybe that's what makes you successful, which is there's a push and pull there, right? Where like in one sentence you're saying, let's standardize things and get these efficiencies. And then the other, you're like, all right, I need a challenge and I need some risk. And because systemizing is taking out the risk, and then you're also saying, I want the risk.
Interesting.
But I don't think that's a bad thing, right? I think that's...
Wow, thanks, Joe. I know myself better. This is cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've been trying to figure out myself a lot too, right? I'm almost a year and a half into a business, and you start to learn so much of it is psychology, you know?
Boy. And nowhere is that more true than in construction, right? I mean, you know, I started in as a carpenter in, I guess it was 1977. And from your perspective, and maybe plenty of the listeners, that's in the distant past. I mean, that's just a couple of weeks after World War II was done. Yeah, I mean, if you weren't alive then, right? And I grew up hearing about an old school mentality where it was all hollering and shouting and screaming and fist fights. And there were certainly still examples of that, particularly in logging. My first man's job was logging. And so that was all part of it. And it still exists, but it's just been interesting to me to see that shift. You know, I'm not, yeah, that shift to a more, I don't know, a kinder, gentler, maybe on the surface of it, less military, less prison mentality, atmosphere and construction. And so maybe my risk thing is trying to go back and input some of that adrenaline that used to happen on the job just as a course of the culture.
Yeah, it's funny. I just shared something recently about how, you know, someone put out a picture of their job site, and just, I mean, it looked beautiful. And one of the things that I do a lot is I write NFPA 241 plans, which are probably not familiar with them, but it's the standard for safeguarding construction. It's a requirement in Massachusetts. And one of the requirements is that once you have a floor, you need a set of code compliant stairs to it.
Oh.
Where historically we would have had gang ladders going up with the iron workers and the stairs are kind of chasing up behind.
Yeah.
Now, is essentially once you've either put the subfloor down, whether it's plywood or you put the concrete down, the next day it's set, it's cured. At that point, you need to have a code compliant set of stairs.
Wow.
Yeah. So what this picture I was looking at and reshared their picture was this really nice, clean site, great fencing, a set of system scaffolding going up ahead of time with the iron workers. So they could walk up. They had a top rail, a mid rail or whatever. And wow. I was like, it's really nice to see how far we come. Because even I remember my first job, you know, it was much more what you were talking about. People were yelling, screaming, the ironworker Stewart would kick down the super's door. You know, it was cavemen. And now I say that, hey, this is great that we're working like this now. But at the same time, it was kind of fun when it was.
And so it
goes back to that push and pull, right? Where
I
think this is great. But I think we went into construction because we didn't want to work in a laboratory.
Right? That's right. Or I mean, it's great. It's great. And I'm sitting here just dazzled at thinking of what you just described. I've never seen anything like that. Okay. And it's dazzling to think that the day after the suspended deck is hard enough to walk on, you got a set of stairs there. Mm-hmm. That the 6 foot wide gang ladders that we would build and lean up so two or three men could pass at the same time, so that's new to me again.
Yeah.
But talking about what that has cost us, because there is a cost. There is an unintended cost and consequence to all these things. I was listening to Mike Rau. Love that guy. Mm-hmm. You know, Mike Rau has a brain about the size of a Volkswagen. And I was listening to him talk about safety third. And of course, that's anathema. I mean, people don't want to ever hear you say anything like that now. And a lot of the pressure that I take in the comments on my channel is that they see me doing something that's not, you know, OSHA certified, and they just can't believe what I'm doing. The irresponsibility of a man to act that way and then put it on YouTube is appalling to them. But there has been a cost making everything. It's getting back to that workmanship of certainty, that your safety is certain, or so we think. And removing that risk of being injured. And everybody wants to go home every night. Your family needs you to come home. And so all that's good. But that push and pull, we shouldn't think that it has been entirely beneficial, because it has not.
Mm. In what way do you think it's not beneficial? I'm not saying I disagree, but...
Yes. First of all, in satisfaction. For me, for people like me and Cy, there's a satisfaction of knowing when you come to the job, you better have your A game on, because you're going to bleed a little bit if you don't. Mm. That's a masculine. There's an element of masculinity there that I think helps maintain interest. Okay, yeah. It keeps interest sharp, and if your interest is not sharp, I mean, why do it? Why do it if you're not interested moment by moment? And as well as the whole productivity piece. And of course, you know, people and cynics will say, well, it's only important to be productive so that the company's bottom line is enhanced. Well, not really. It's important to be productive so that I can continue to regard myself as being worthwhile. Because at the end of the day, if I haven't been productive, I know it. And that's a sick feeling to go home and think, I was a food waster today. I consumed more than I produced. And I think that degrades our quality of life.
Yeah, no, there's absolutely something to the efficiency of, I mean, think about the feeling, even if it's just the paperwork or not even building something, but just when you have a day where like, holy shit, like I got a lot done today. Okay,
yeah.
This is what I needed. Like that feels good, right?
It does feel good.
Versus a day where you're like, wow, I just worked for 6-8 hours and like, I got crap done because I couldn't get it together, right?
So now rewind the tape back 25 or 30 years. There's an additional element of feel good when you think, I got a lot of stuff done and I could have been hurt at any second, okay? Mm-hmm. And I still got it done. I'll tell you, now I'm not saying that that's wise. I'm not saying it's sustainable, and I'm not saying you should ever inflict that on another person, but man, I used to love it. I used to love it.
No, I like your candidness. I mean... I'd have to say, like, you know, and I don't think that this is what you're saying, but obviously we don't want to put anybody at risk.
No.
Right?
No. We can't. Morally, we cannot.
Yeah. But I think what you're picking at to some degree is there's been a sterilization of our society as a whole.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Where people are being, you know, silenced or not allowed to say things.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way they feel. And as we get more and more sterile and you can't truly be yourself in a lot of times with men, where you look at the suicide rate of males versus females.
Yep.
It is extremely higher amongst men.
Yep.
You know, and you look at it, and a lot of the narrative is that, well, men and white men in particular have a very advantageous position over everybody else. And
right.
They probably do in the business world.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But when boys are, and we're talking just men here because I can't speak about women because I'm not a woman, but a
sure.
woman. But when boys don't have the opportunity to be boys, you know, there's something that suffers. And
boy,
you know, I can't drill down completely on it, but I think that's the concept yeah. that you're feeling with the, I just want some risk.
I think you're absolutely right. And I've long had unsubstantiated theories about this. And I recognize that in many cases, my opinions are strongest in the areas where I have the least data. Okay, now I recognize that that's not smart, it's not helpful. I can't help it. I think maybe a lot of us do that. I mean, our confirmation bias substitutes for real information sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I see young people, I see crime, I see violence, I see gang activity, I see extreme sports. Think about base jumping. Yeah. Think about Alex Hanold climbing El Cap. Think about these things that we revere, and the things that we are afraid of that are all potentially violent and harmful. I think that is the young male's cry, that I need some risk in my life. If I don't have some risk, how do I know I'm alive? If injury and even death is not on my horizon from time to time, then all the days in between sort of fade, right? I listen to Jordan Peterson, or I have quite a bit. I haven't been able to lately just because of the pace of my life. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that I've heard him say this, but in this conversation, I'm realizing that fulfillment is greater than security and being sanitary. Mm-hmm. That the fulfillment that can come from living a life where the life itself is something you've got to guard a little bit. That's yeah. part of, I think, fulfillment that is greater than just knowing, hey, I got it made.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are thinking, as society, as we become more civil, mm-hmm. And there's less war and famine, and there isn't the Black Plague anymore, because there's no real risk in our life, the human brain is evolutionarily wired to find fear in
yep.
potential problems, because it and wow, where this podcast is going, people are like, what the hell's going on?
But, I'm sorry.
No, I like it, so too bad. It's my podcast.
That's right.
You know, where we're hardwired to default to find the things that are potentially wrong versus what's going right.
Yeah.
And that's just a way to protect ourselves, because if you were wrong about the black bear, mm-hmm. you were dead.
Really right? wrong. Yeah.
So we're more hardwired to look for things that are wrong. So when less and less things are wrong and the world is getting better and better, mm-hmm. we're now finding things that aren't really that much of a problem.
Yes.
And we're making them into a problem.
Yeah. We're busy tearing down utopia. Every time in the past, looking at this day, we would have said, that's it. Some growing number of those people. I mean, with poverty worldwide falling and all these things, mm-hmm. it would be easy to say, wow, you know, things are finally falling into line. And instead, we find ourselves looking for opportunities to be dissatisfied and input. Anyhow, it's interesting. And we're a long ways from construction, but thanks for indulging me.
Yeah, no, I think I'm equally as guilty in leading us down this path. I mean, I listen to this guy, Gary Vee, once in a while as well. You know, and he talks along this line, and it ties into the thinkers that are thinking about it from an evolutionary perspective. But he goes, we have a problem when somebody is in Starbucks yelling at a barista because they got the wrong fucking milk.
That's right? What I'm talking about.
You know, and he's like, think about that for a minute. He goes, you're buying a $7 fucking cup of coffee and you're upset over the kind of milk.
Yeah.
You know, your perspective is off.
You are screwed up. Yeah.
But let me take a hard right turn now,
because
it was funny when the young lady on your team kind of reached out to me originally. I was thinking, like, okay, I don't know if this is really the right fit. So I want to dig in a little bit more on you. And mm-hmm. as I did, the thing that I really liked, and which is a theme that, I don't know if it's a theme, but it's really why I started this, which is I think construction is a great opportunity, a mm-hmm. great field. You can do so many things, from blue collar to a project manager to, if you like logistics, being a superintendent. If you're into technology, you know, you can do VDC and BIM modeling, and there's mm-hmm. so many opportunities in there. And I want this podcast to be a way to display, hey, what are the opportunities that are out there?
Yeah. Whether
buying land and developing something, to working with tools, to being an estimator if you love spreadsheets. And when I saw your path, I was like, wow, this kind of fits. This is the message that I think we need out there in construction, which is you have a lot of opportunities and you have a chance at variety and excitement and really cool things. So your original path was via a logger. And then where did you go from there?
Yeah, so coming out of high school, I did well in math and hard science. Well, I did well in a small high school. I didn't realize that in a bigger pond, I was only high medium. And so I went to Oregon State for a while and thought I was going to be an engineer. Simultaneously, I was playing music in a Dixieland jazz band and the music won out. I remember thinking this brilliant thought. Okay, you ready for a brilliant thought from a 18-year-old? What do I need an education for? I'm going to be a star. Okay, I remember thinking that.
Hey.
And so, well.
50 years later.
Yeah, sort of. Sort of. And so.
40, yeah.
Yeah, so I jotted down a few notes because I did the music thing and then I realized that was not a path to happiness for me. And then I remember thinking, well, I guess I'll build houses because I had always liked making things, tree houses and boats. I grew up liking to connect things. And so I thought, well, I will learn to build houses. And so Kelly and I got married. I met her when I was 15 years old on the school bus and she's been terrific. And so right here in Roseburg, I thought, well, I guess I need a contractor's license. And so I went down and I did what I needed to do to get a contractor's license. And when I had built all of the carports and decks for my friends and family, I was out of work. And that coincided with the recession. And I realized as I was sort of sketching this that recession was a driver for me for new skills. And at the time, I didn't see that. And so then the recession came along and I thought, well, I had access. My wife's grandfather was had been a sawmill man in southwestern Oregon from 1935 to 1945. And he had this sort of a small sawmill all rusted down in a field. And when I was dating his granddaughter, he told me I could have it. And so now I had married his granddaughter and construction had gotten slow. And I didn't know a thing about marketing. I didn't know much about carpentry. I had worked for I had maybe a year under my belt working for a couple of small contractors. And so I thought, well, why don't I build that sawmill portable? Now, this was before Wood Misers or Mighty Mites or any of the portable sawmills now. And I had had a welding class in high school, so I thought I could weld. So I built a portable sawmill, and I ran that for a while. And then, predictably, that wasn't working. Because, like, I didn't know how to market. The internet didn't exist. I didn't know how to generate the work. And recession was tightening its grip in Southern Oregon. And so I thought, well, I need to go. I've got a family now. I need to go somewhere where there's work as a carpenter. I could see that that was more viable. And Wyoming was booming. The oil economy, the uranium mining, and agriculture, all commodities, were on the high side. And I didn't know anything about boom and bust cycles and commodities then. And so off we went to northwestern Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And I went to work for a residential builder, quality guys, a couple quality guys, you know. And so I got to look at some more stuff and did a little welding. And then recession came to Wyoming after about 5 years. And those commodities cycled down and work got tighter and tighter. But Las Vegas was booming. And I had Kelly's biological father was there. So I thought, well, being an economic refugee, which is what construction workers can find themselves as,
yeah.
Economic refugees, right? Mm-hmm. Off I went to Las Vegas. I had money enough. I left Kelly and two little kids in northwestern Wyoming, a little place that we'd bought. New Year's Day, I blasted down to Las Vegas, and I had money enough. I knew I could take 2 weeks and try to understand the construction circles, the cliques, the groups, the types of work, you know, union, non-union, what paid. And so I took about 2 weeks and I stopped on every job site I could come to, and I would walk onto the site, and the first man that would talk to me, I would always ask the same question, hey, how do you like your job? And after about 10 days, I ran out of money. So I took a week's work for cash, helping a guy do some pickup framing in a little office building. And I got fueled back up, and I kept, and after about 10 days, I realized that Martin Harris Construction was the company I was going to work for. And so I started going down to their office and banging on their door, making a pest of myself, which I had already learned as a way to be hired. You find out who makes a decision, you plague their life until they hire you to be done with the problem. And so I went to work commercial construction in Las Vegas, and I learned a lot in a hurry. So did that for a while, got my nose out of joint about some perceived inequities that I thought I could probably do better. Heard that in the tracts, the piece workers were making real money. And as a young dad, money was important. Mm. And so I jumped out of the union, commercial concrete, commercial construction, red iron, structural steel, shopping mall, churches kind of a thing, small high rises on the strip, that sort of thing. And I jumped over to piecework in the tracts. And let me tell you, that was an eye-opening experience about efficiency. That was about contemporary with Larry Hahn and his book, The Very Efficient Carpenter. And so some of his techniques and his systems were showing up. Of course, they already showed up. You know, California, Los Angeles, California American Southwest pioneered, I think, some of the most efficient residential framing techniques on the planet. And so they were being published and guys were using them. And so I learned that stuff. And a piecework mentality is something you absolutely want in a carpenter if he also has a quality bone. If he also recognizes a good job and is happy to gear back, if you can hire a guy with experience in piecework, you're going to hire a man who will know how to be productive. And so anyhow, so that was important.
No. I was pausing just to phrase it right. So typically when I hear piecework, I think of more of people hanging drywall.
Right.
What were you doing for piecework?
Yeah, that's a great question. Residential framing, American Southwest, in many cases, is specialized to a point you can't imagine. You will have a layout man who's in there, has a square foot number. I don't know what the numbers are now, but let's say it's a quarter of a square foot. And he'll walk onto the slabs, because it's mostly slab-on-grade construction, and he'll have maybe 30 houses in front of him. And there are three different house plans, and each house plan has three different front elevations. And he'll start snapping the wall lines right down those 30 houses, snap, 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 for one amount of money. And then there will be a plater. Two guys will come in, will plate. They'll throw the plates down. They'll drill them around the perimeter and throw the plates down on those snap lines. And then that layout man will come back around and detail those plates. He'll put the marks on them, you know, the corners and the channels and the stud layout, the openings. He'll mark the stud heights, and he will cut the window and opening packages. He'll cut the headers, the top cripples, the sills, the bottom cripples, and the trimmers in the openings. And he'll lay those at the openings, and it's all marked and detailed so that the framers, the wall framers who come in, for their per lineal foot of wall or per square foot of building, will frame those walls and stand them and plumb and line, okay? Brace them off. And then there'll be somebody, a couple of guys usually that come in, and they have an agreement to joist it, unless it's a single story, and then they'll stack it. They'll roll the trusses or cut and stack, you know, cut the rafters and put the blocking, you know, fire blocking, eave blocking, ridge blocking, and sheetrock backing in. Or if it's a two-story, they just roll the joists, block them, nail them down, and then somebody will come in to put the decking on. And then somebody will come in to screw the decking off. And then, so every little portion of the residential framing process is broken down into a piece price.
Mm. And typically square foot.
Square foot, typically, almost always. You know, yep. Although there will be some lump sum agreements, there will be a house where the exterior elevations, you know, the plant-ons that all stucco, and the interior elevations pay a certain amount of money.
Yeah.
And there will be guys who in the big tracks like Del Webb, Sun City Developments, where they're knocking out, you know, five houses every single day. There will be maybe two guys or three who are doing pickup, and they're walking into those finished houses and they're just doing putting in the blocks and straightening the studs and doing the work that got overlooked in the piece price agreements, and they're doing it for some amount of money per house. Mm. So there's some lump sum, but mostly piece price. And so if you can find somebody that's had that experience, they are going to know how to develop a system for whatever they're doing. And you're going to have to watch them because they also know how to short nail. They know how to, you know, like I say, if they don't have a quality conscious bone, they can hurt you. But if they do, you've got the best of all possible worlds in a framing carpenter.
Yeah.
Okay. So, question.
Forgive me for interrupting. I'm just Please. Looking at the clock a little bit. And there's one thing I really wanted to get into with you. So part of your process between musician, first run at construction, logging, back into construction,
yes. doing
piecework stuff, you eventually had your own general contracting business.
Right.
What was your experience with owning your own business, and in particular, being a general contractor?
Great question. To just quickly resolve the preliminary work, I went from the framing to commercial concrete to superintending a startup concrete company, tilt-ups and small bridges and that. And then I burned out on Las Vegas, came back to Oregon, and got back into general contracting because logging was no longer going to sustain me. So my experience as a general contractor was I confronted and was limited by the fact that I loved the work and didn't really like the business, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
In the rearview mirror, I realized I have always loved making things. I never got done being that boy who wanted to build a treehouse, who thought, I think I can build a boat. And so being a small general contractor gave me all these opportunities to take these splendid jobs, whether it's a decorative suspended concrete deck with a fabricated steel and stainless steel railing, or an in-ground swimming pool on a 40% hillside, or whatever it was. I would take these jobs that nobody else wanted because I had to figure them out. But the business thing, I was never smart enough to realize that I had to be doing it also for the money. And so as a businessman, I've been a low end. I've been compromised. It always bothered me to hire guys because I took responsibility for their welfare. And so it added an element of pressure, and man, I'm struggling enough to feed my family. Why would I want to feed someone else's? And of course that's not rational, but to your question, my experience of being a general contractor, it gave me these wonderful opportunities to meet people, identify their needs, help them identify their needs, and then provide a solution to what their needs were. And there has been a lot of fulfillment in that, and I've learned a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I have a good friend. His name is John Lyons. I used to work with him. He's a great carpenter, but he often talks about how most residential construction companies are just scraping by.
Yes.
You know, they're not thriving.
Just.
You know, and people think like, oh, well, they have their own company. They're doing this. He's like, they're just not. He goes, it's too competitive. They don't. His kind of theory is you start in, forgive me, John, if I'm wrong, but, you know, you start off building decks mm-hmm. and sheds or whatever, and next thing you know, you're doing kitchen renovations and then
building
a home. But because you loved construction, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But they don't understand, back to your systems point, the way to run a business.
That's
not
right.
Building, not run a business.
And exactly.
Two distinct things. And his theory is that the folks that worked on the commercial side, and then moved over to the residential. Let's say they became a project manager for some commercial contractor, but always they did it because they loved construction mm-hmm. and they liked, you know, carpentry or whatever. And they say, you know what, this isn't for me. I'm going to go start my own business and do what I love and do craftsmanship.
Mm-hmm.
he says those people do well because they understand the systems. You work at a commercial construction project, you understand contracts, you understand schedule, you understand coordinating subs, you understand insurance and the risk involved and the to start building a deck, right?
Yes.
So I think to some degree that's what you were experiencing, maybe.
Yes. I think there's a lot of truth to that. And the other thing that you have a chance of understanding coming from commercial is the difference between work that has a profit margin in it and work that doesn't. And anytime you're working for Mrs. McElhenney, anytime you're working on the Crichton's deck, they don't really have any money to spend on that. Right. And they certainly don't have enough money to spend on that so that you're going to walk away with 30% of that job in your pocket when all the dust settles and all the smoke clears that you actually have some money. It was never there. But if, on the other hand, you're doing some tenant improvement works in a, I don't know, a Dollar General or a Walmart, now there's some margin there because those people want to get into business and they want that machine to start creating money. And so everyone that works on it is going to get a little taste of that money or can. And so residential work has no money because most people don't have money.
Yeah.
Or at least the people that we know. The people that we know, most of them don't have money.
Right. No, absolutely. The super high end might be a different thing. But you also had an interesting concept about the financing involved with general contracting, and kind of what you learned about, you know, to some degree your... I'm going to phrase this improperly, but you know, you're like a bank, right?
Yeah. And see, that is very interesting. So one of the things that dawned on me when I began to, when I stepped into this business world was, okay, I can probably recover from some bad workmanship by a subcontractor. And I can probably recover maybe from a little bit of bad design if it can be repaired, but I will never recover from somebody failing to pay. Okay, and I thought, now that's interesting that in all the work I'm doing, the thing that could sink me is not the work, but the failure to pay. And then it dawned on me that contractors are in the business of lending and borrowing money. Let me make sure I'm phrasing this right. That we enter into agreements, and if we're careful, we get a little money up front, which is borrowed money. The client is lending, and we're promising to repay in the form of men and material and work. But on the other hand, as soon as we run by that deposit or get behind on the frequency of payments, we are in the process of lending money in the form of men, material, and workmanship with the promise of being repaid in cash from the person who's... And so when it dawned on me that I was actually functioning as a little bank, it completely changed how I thought about who am I willing to work for and how am I able to secure my position. Closely related to that was how am I going to charge enough money so that if they are slow to pay or if they have a financial catastrophe, I'll still be standing. And so the whole thing about controlling money, very late in the game, I realized was key to success as a contractor.
Yeah, no, I think when you were first talking about that, when we were chatting on the phone, I said, that's a great way to like zoom out and look at it.
Yeah.
You know, you're in this. I don't think this is the first time that somebody's thought about it that way. Just it hadn't been me. Sure. I think a lot of people kind of understand that, especially on the commercial side.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, you say, you know, loaning them with men and time and work, but in reality it's cash too, because
that's exactly right.
You know,
it's value. It's value.
It goes up front with the risk of non-payment,
you know, or
slow payment. And now you need to get credit to pay for the next thing because the prior person hasn't paid you. Now that prior person is taking that delta, whatever the interest you're paying on that is because of that person prior that you lent money that you weren't getting interest on.
See, that is so true. And your comment about the larger commercial companies understanding that is true. And it speaks to something that I think is very counterintuitive. And that is small contractors like me have a much higher overhead than Bechtel or Brown and Root. Because Brown and Root, Bechtel, these big boys have whole departments that deal with, number one, risk management, financial risk management. They do credit research. They get a credit report. They understand the credit history of every client. And they have collections department. They can get their money one way or the other. And that is just, that's built into their overhead. It's just happening. Nobody has to think about it. But a small flyer like me and maybe other people who are listening need to understand that since I am functioning as the credit department, since I have to do the all of this analysis of prospective clients and bill and collect the money, that as a percentage of my effort, my overhead is much higher and frankly harder to come by than it is for the bigger companies, which is counterintuitive. And I think it's something that gets back to the fact, which is the big piece, that little players have to learn how to charge. The hardest part of being a general contractor for a small player is to figure your costs, put an ample overhead and profit markup, more than ample, and look them right in the eye and say, here's what it's going to cost. That's the toughest moment as a small general contractor.
I agree. Even myself, I mean, I do co-consulting and education, and I'm not a general contractor. But, you know, on occasion, I've had people push back like, whoa, that's a lot. And then I walk them through it.
Yes.
And I said, here's my time. This is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to purchase. Here's where I'm going to go. It takes me an hour to drive down there to pick up all the copiers. And we've already had 17 emails.
That's right.
You know, and you start looking at it and those hours add up. And I'm paying for insurance and I'm paying for, you know, transportation. And I'm going to get to your place. And we work in downtown Boston and it's $40 for me to park. And I'm going to come out there four times. That's $250. And yeah. There's traffic. So if we have a meeting at 3, I need to leave at 1 to make sure that I'm there on time so I'm not late. And there's 2 hours. And, you know, so you start walking them through and say, okay, so how much do you want to be paid for 37 hours of your time?
That's right. That's right. And then the mistake that small players make is thinking, well, it doesn't cost me that much and I really need the job and so I can throw that in. And that's food that's coming off of your table. Those are opportunities and things that your children will not receive because you gratuitously throw it in because darn it, I want the job. What a thinking error that is.
It is. I really hope that people that are listening to this, if they're in that position that, you know, maybe this helps. You know, I need to continue to talk through it. I'm not acting like I have it figured out by any means, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure we all struggle with it, right? Especially when you're dealing with individuals versus all general, right?
Yeah.
But okay, we're bumping up on an hour, but this
wow,
it's been enjoyable. But there's a couple of things I still. Do you have time? I want to.
I have time. It's still only 6:30 out here, so I may have a schedule.
I forget, but you got a lot going on, so I want to check. I might be off and it might just be very basic, but I have a feeling that you're doing what you're doing for a lot of different reasons. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing what you're doing now? Like, it's not just to make money, like you're past that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Why are you doing what you're doing?
So the short answer is because it was my son's idea. And the initial answer is that Kelly and I resolved a long time ago that do you have kids, Joe? Do you have kids?
Just one, a four-year-old boy. Yeah.
Okay. So here's what's in your future. That four-year-old boy will turn into a man. And it is much harder to have a balanced, give and take, equally valued relationship with an adult child than the relationship with a four-year-old where it's completely imbalanced. It's tricky maintaining a relationship with an adult who happens to be your child, where both people are equally happy to be in the relationship and where both people, you know, it's hard to make time. I'm thinking of that Cat Stevens song, you know, not Cat Stevens, the Cats in the Cradle, you know, talking about my boy is just like me. So a few years ago, Nate came to me with this idea about YouTube videos. Kelly and I had decided that anytime one of our adult children comes with an idea that's not going to hurt them and not going to hurt us, we should nod our head and say, yeah, let's try that. So I said, okay, let's try that. And his instinct about social media has been so perfect. I don't know where the kid got this skill set, but he nailed it right from the beginning. And so it began to take off. And then that dynamic of of following up on his good idea was replaced by, wow, this feels like it's important and we're both enjoying it, and it feels like it's having a positive impact in some number of people's lives. Long after I thought that my son had, that my S-U-N, that the sun had set on my most important days, you know, I'd had whatever influence and the kids were raised and I'd done it, and so we'll just ride this out to the end of the track, right? All of a sudden, it's a new deal where I am connected with hundreds of thousands of people in what feels like a fairly significant way. And that is what I think is really going on here, a connection with people and teaching them things that has a possibility of helping them.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a great thing for people to understand that, you know, life is short, but it's long.
Yeah.
And like sometimes a lot of people think like, oh, I've missed the boat or whatever. Yeah. You haven't missed the boat. You know, that's what right. is it? It's like Sam Walton started Walmart in his like 40s, I want to say.
Yeah.
Something like that. You know, it's not over at 60 anymore.
It is not over at 60.
Yeah.
And the whole internet thing is radically changing the landscape about education. If I was in the university business right now, I would be real nervous about YouTube because of the boatloads of information that are available free. And as soon as somebody solves the question about how to establish, how to attach a credential, how to get viability and marketability to the information that's coming off of YouTube, the university world is going to be on its ear. Now, I don't know how soon that's going to happen or how it's going to happen, but I have no doubt that somebody's going to solve that.
Yeah, I think the concept is right. And this is actually the closing questions that I always have is, what do you think we're going to see more of and what are you going to think we're going to see less of? And I think we're going to talk about it right now, so we might be able to save ourselves a question.
Good.
But I think two things. I think, yes, you need that certification via online, which I guess some degree is happening with like University of Phoenix and things like that. Now, they're not respected at this point.
Right. Right.
But this is going to get to a point where those are going to be respected. And
yes,
there are more and more respectable institutions that I think are being forward thinking in allowing more and more of that education to happen online.
Yes.
And if they could bring the cost structure down and do it that way, I think that's successful. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, maybe people don't need that piece of paper in the future. And you're looking at, I forget, it was one of, I know they're not the big six anymore, but big four accounting firms, whatever they are now, it was about 3 weeks ago, they changed their standards that you no longer need a bachelor's degree as a minimum standard to apply.
Okay.
Quite interesting.
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. You know, so yeah, I think our future is, I'm not saying anything novel here. Our future is going to look a lot different.
And it's going to look different in ways that we are not entertaining. It's going to look different in ways that we can't even sit here and brainstorm, probably. But this whole podcasting thing that you are establishing a footprint in, like Jordan Peterson says, is making available to people opportunities for learning in connection with what they're already doing. That educational content can be pouring into our heads as high level as we can run with. That there are podcasts and that are formal discourse where you have to stop and rewind it and listen again to even come close to understanding what those guys just said. How is that not higher education? And you're able to do that while you're driving nails through a bottom plate into 2x6 studs if you want.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can listen to rock and roll. Or you can listen, whatever you want, but we now have the opportunity to use the moments that are not otherwise committed to really change what it is that we know and what we're capable of doing and what we know about why we're doing these things. I think it's revolutionary.
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to my brother-in-law over the last week. I was on vacation, was down in Philadelphia. And, you know, we were talking a bit about how parents had made mistakes in raising children, you know, and we have to be understanding, because it's, you know, you and I have the opportunity to listen to podcasts and have all this information at our fingertips to learn how to better raise children and why people act the way they do. They do. Good English, Joe. They do. talking about being educated, huh? but so we need to cut them some slack because we put them in our frame where we have all this access to information. We can learn all these things. They didn't have those opportunities. They couldn't drive in the car and hear a PhD speak to them about evolutionary psychology or childhood trauma or any of the things that have at our fingertips.
That's right. It's the mistake we make when we think about history at all, that we always judge the past according to the opportunities and the knowledge that are available in the present. It's a huge mistake all the time, even starting with our parents.
Yeah. And my brother-in-law, who I, you know, was very bright, but he also, I think, was flawed. And he made a statement. He's like, well, they had the library. And I said, yeah, but you got to know what to look for. You know, I read this guy, Gabor Mate, who I think is fascinating. He wrote this book, When the Body Says No, right? And there's no way I find him without a podcast. I wouldn't know to go to the library to look for that book, right? So I think we underestimate the advantage we have right now. We have
search engine. You know, the advantage of search engines. Think the tedium of research that is obviated that no one in the future will ever understand. I think you're exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I'm going to ask it, and maybe it's going to be, it's what we just said, but from your perspective, and you probably have a more unique perspective than anybody else I've had on, what do you think over the next 1 to 2 years, maybe it's 5 years, that we don't have to be specific, what do you think we're going to see more of, and what do you think we're going to see less of? And you can just pick one of the two, you can go in any order, you can go for it, but I think you get the concept I'm driving at.
Yeah. So first disclaimer, it's a little outside of my wheelhouse. My crystal ball has never worked at all. But I think that the Amazon phenomenon of buying things of accessing bulk sales and the cost driver that accesses and the way that's spilling over even to construction supplies, I think that's going to grow and grow and grow. I think it's going to put more and more pressure on the small local provider. Not an original thought. The information that we just talked about access to all the knowledge there is, that some segment of our population is going to learn to capitalize on it and all the rest are going to be left behind. I think that thinking about your question and understanding that I don't know, but I think that that learning through social media is going to grow faster than any other type of learning. And whatever it is that learning does for society and for individuals, it's going to be on steroids through social media. And I think that that's going to have consequences in every aspect of our world. And if we have the eyes to see that, we'll be able to take advantage of it in the best sense, or ignore it and be steamrolled by it, like has happened for most of us with most of these technological shifts.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And one thing, we didn't get to cover it when we were talking earlier about what you do. And I want to say a couple things. The one thing that I really enjoy about your videos is, and maybe it's just me, they're so relaxing.
Really? Right?
Yeah, like your voice, you've got the right voice, the music, and like in particular, the one where you were pouring the concrete slab for a patio.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
and just watching somebody screed the concrete, finish the concrete. And what I also love is I watch it with my 4-year-old. Okay.
I love that.
And we both love it. I'm someone that has built 40-something story, combined 240 story buildings side by side, $750 million project as a superintendent next to a 4-year-old. And we're both watching your video about construction and both enjoying it and loving it. And it's special. I think it's great, you know?
So that is the best answer to your question about why I'm doing what I'm doing. And I didn't start that way. There was no way that Nate and I could anticipate your response. Let me repeat that. There was no way that I could have imagined that. What are you, 38 or something? However old you are. Okay.
I'm older than you think.
Yeah. That good on you. There's no way I could imagine a young dad and a four-year-old sitting there watching me do what I do and what my friends do, I could not conceive of that. And now to hear that it's a benefit to you as a parent and that it has some sort of a positive influence in the walls of your home, which is the most important space you ever occupy, by the way. Here's an old man speaking. Mm-hmm. Don't overlook the good that you have to do there. That's the reason that we are hopeful about the long-term viability and positive effect of essential craftsmen.
Yeah. And I want you to know, like, my son gets...
I just lost you.
What I was saying was my son gets almost no screen time. He gets maybe an hour a week tops.
Brilliant.
So it's not like he's seeing all kinds of things. He's
what's his name?
Matthew.
Matthew, that a boy, Matthew. Thanks for watching. Listen to your dad.
It was funny. He's not around this morning. I wanted to have him come in and say hello to you on Skype. He would have loved it. And then the other thing that I wanted to talk about your show is I like what you're doing with the Spec House. So you've kind of morphed from individual topics like ladder safety, maintaining and purchasing chainsaws, laying out, framing, finishing concrete, blacksmithing, to now you have this concept of, okay, we're going to build a house and you're going to get to see step by step the process about how this house goes together in short videos for, you know, we're going to do the footings, we're going to do the layout, we're going to do the excavation. And I think that is a great learning tool for folks that are listening. So if you get a chance, look up Essential Craftsman on YouTube, check out the Spec House. I want to make sure I compliment you. I think that it's a great tool. And Scott, I'll say this, I really enjoyed this conversation. And you know what? I would be angry, but even if this thing didn't record, I'm happy we had this conversation. So I'm happy we had it for the podcast, but I really enjoyed talking to you. This was great. So thanks for coming by. I appreciate it. And hopefully we'll chat again.
Thanks for the invitation. Thanks for watching. And Joe, will you keep up the good work? I think you're doing great.
Great. Thanks, Scott.
See ya.
Okay, folks, I thought Scott was awesome. There's a lot of wisdom that comes with that much experience. I thought his comment about fulfillment being greater than security, that really hit home with me. I'll also include the two books that he referenced in the show. I'll include that in the show notes, a couple links so everyone can find them. If you loved Scott as much as I did, please share this any way you see fit. Take care and see you next week.
We out.